Welcome back to another episode of Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler. On this podcast, we explore all things related to thriving and flourishing in life. There are three fundamental truths that inform not just my podcast, but my coaching as well. And they are, number one, the future can be changed. You are not stuck and you are not trapped by your predictable future. Wherever you are right now, it's just your present state. It does not determine where you can go in life. Fundamental truth number two, you can change your future. This might be the best news of all. You don't need to be rescued by someone else. You can do that for yourself. In other words, you can be your own hero. And fundamental truth number three, you do not have to wait. Too many people think that they have to have the perfect plan or all the knowledge or all the skills before they can get started. Nothing is further from the truth. I've coached a lot of people in my career. And trust me when I say that you can learn whatever it is that you need to learn along the way. The key is to start. If you've listened to the podcast before, you'll probably know that we find stories and experts who shed light on these different areas so that we can all flourish and thrive. Let's dive in to today's episode. My guest today was, up until his late 30s, a sedentary, overweight smoker and stuck in an abusive and unhealthy relationship. It was clear that if he was going to enjoy any kind of satisfaction in life, he had to stop focusing on what others wanted out of him and zero in on what he wanted for himself. Since then, he has become an entrepreneur, an author, a speaker, an ultra athlete, and a philanthropist. And he has continually sought the limits of his physical, emotional, and mental capacities. In the weeks before his sister passed away from brain cancer, he promised he would run for 24 hours straight to raise money to help others fight cancer. Over the last 15 years, he has completed several more events, including 24-hour runs, an 87-mile run in the heat of a Mexican summer, a 104-mile run along the Pacific Coast Highway, long bike rides, various other endurance events, as well as some Ironman triathlons. His most recent adventure was a nearly 5,000-mile solo bike ride across the country in which he visited most of the participants for his book, Cycle of Lives, which is an Amazon number one bestseller, and it chronicles the stories of 15 people's remarkable and unique emotional journeys with cancer. His name is David Richman, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bobby. I'm happy to be here. I'm very excited to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You have a very interesting story. We're kind of chatting about the biking aspect of it, but why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do and that type of thing?
Sure. So who I am, my name is David Richman. I have multiple facets of my life, like most people do. I have a background in finance, but I don't really talk about that much. You know, more than anything else, I have twins that are finishing up their master's programs, different universities. They're a big part of my life. I'm married, very happily married. I'm an endurance athlete. I don't know how people define that for themselves, but for me, that means that I'm always looking to push myself. I do Ironmans usually once or sometimes twice a year. I pick up one big endurance event to do every couple of years. The last one I did was a solo 5,000-mile bike ride across the country in a pretty short amount of time. I'm a writer. That's how I spend most of my time, is writing, fiction, nonfiction. And I think that's what brought us together, is to talk about that in relation to my most recent book, which explores the deep emotions, that not any other facet, but just the emotional side of the cancer experience.
Yeah. And that one is the, what's the name of that? Because I know you've got two.
Yeah, I got two out there that are not like industry specific or sports specific. This one is Cycle of Lives. And where the title comes from, Bobby, is I kind of wanted this play on words. I feel like Cycle of Lives, it's like, life is an affinity. It's like a circle. You got wheels on a bike that are like that. And then I wanted like a full cycle of things. So I've got young and old, I've got men and women, I've got caregiver, survivor, loved one, doctor. I've got people that had one cancer one time and done, people that had it, you know, five times over a 35 year period, people who had a vast array of traumas that led up to determining how they would deal with their cancer, the emotions behind it. Varying traumas, you know, like abuse, alcohol addiction, abandonment, all these different things. So I just wanted to give the listeners and you, cycle of lives is that like, it's a cycle, like there's multiple spokes, there's all these different perspectives, and it's all kind of circular and tied together. So that was the meaning behind the title.
Yeah, I love that. And now that's when you rode the 5,000 miles, right? To interview these different people? 15 right?
Well, so here's what happened. No, I interviewed way more than 15 people, and I interviewed them for a few years because what I wanted to do was, and this was before the age of Zoom. I mean, we had teleconferencing, but I wanted to talk on the phone so people would be a little less hesitant, because I think it's a little easier sometimes to talk into the phone than it is into a camera. But I interviewed people. I found interesting people through cold calling, through asking for referrals, through friends of friends, through, you know, literally cold calling cancer centers saying, here's what I'm doing. Wow. And who do you know? And I wanted to find people who had these crazy, interesting stories that say went from birth to point A. Point A is when they encountered cancer. So either as a kid who saw their parent going through cancer, or as a teenager who went on a field trip and said, oh my God, I'm going to become a doctor, or as a adult whose spouse encountered cancer. So birth to point A, what kind of traumas did you experience? Point A is when you encounter cancer. Point B is today. What's the emotional journey you've taken from A to B in relation to those other traumas? Because in interviewing way more than 15 people, Bobby, but narrowing it down to 15, what I wanted to do was to give the reader a real sense of, you know, like when you say something trite, like you never know what people have been through, you never know what people are going through. I agree with that, but it doesn't guide me. It doesn't help me engage in these tough conversations with the people that I know and love. But by bringing all of these crazy stories that I think we might be able to somewhat identify with, if not just be moved into understanding what people might be going through, then when it comes to our real life, maybe we can apply something that we've learned in that book through people's real life experiences to go, maybe I can deal with it this way. Maybe I can talk to people this way. And so, very long answer to your question. Once I had interviewed them and kind of gotten, you know, rid of the people, not rid of, but stop talking to the people that where we couldn't get deep enough, where I had 15 remarkably moving, insightful, inspiring stories. Then I got on the bike and said, since we're all connected, right? Since it's circular, since it's a cycle of life thing, why don't I just go bike to meet them all for the first time? And so I kind of zigzagged my way across and up the country so I could see him. I had known a couple of them in person, but most of them I hadn't met in person. So that was the impetus for the ride, is to add one more kind of point of connection.
Yeah. Love that. So you interviewed a lot of people, kind of narrowed it down to the 15.
Yep.
What are some of the, I guess, biggest lessons or biggest takeaways for you?
Yeah, it kind of depends on which aspect we're talking about, because there's the 15 stories that I think are each unbelievably evocative. They're very moving. They're very inspirational. And I think I could learn something from each one of those stories. And I tried to, I didn't pose myself on the story. The stories are told independent, separate of me. In between each story is a small narrative that includes the bike ride and also my interaction with the book participants, very small amount of that. And then also me kind of trying to reconcile the trauma of losing my only sister to cancer years before. And so what did I learn kind of is a really big question. I learned a ton, but I learned such things as, how do you find love after losing the love of your life to cancer, right? Mm-hmm. What I learned was, what in the world, how crazy is it what our physicians sometimes go through, and how can I be a better patient? I've learned, you want to hear a shocking one, Bobby? I learned how somebody could be happy or maybe more relieved to receive a cancer diagnosis.
Really? That
might have been a terminal diagnosis, and it provided a sense of comfort and relief to them. I'll tell you that story in a minute, but
yeah,
I learned tons. So the wonderful thing is that I didn't want to go into this to learn how to deal with my own issues. Because I didn't think that was interesting enough. I wanted to go in this to uncover what issues people might be going through that I didn't understand or even know about, because I knew they were there.
Yeah.
I knew they were there. I'll tell you super quick, Bobby, when I first thought about this story was because I went to do a 24-hour Relay for Life for the American Cancer Society in honor of my sister. She had died literally 2 days before that cycle, the Relay for Life. And everybody was super talkative. Where do I get my next PET scan? How do I reduce my stress? Where do you get taken care of? How do you deal with kids while you're going through chemo? You know, how do I eat better? How do I sleep better? And then when it came to, how are you doing with all of this? Like, how are you handling it? Zip, nada. We don't talk about the emotional side of it. And I was shocked, right? Even one of the oncologists I spoke to, 40 years, she's been an oncologist. Amazing, amazing story. When I asked her who she had talked to about the emotions behind the things that she had experienced over that 40-year period, she said, besides you, no one. Let's see what we find out, right? People don't talk about the emotional side of it. And that was a very common theme. So what I wanted to go do was uncover, what do I need to learn? And what can I show people? So twice now, I'm giving you a super long answer, Bobby.
That's okay.
The question of what did I learn? I tons. Like, every story was a learning experience.
Yeah. Man, I'm kind of shocked that people don't talk about the emotional side of it. How can you not?
Well, so here, I'll give you an example. Okay. So I am in New Mexico, and I'm biking from Santa Fe into Santa Fe. And I have a friend that joined me for a day or two to help support me. And he said, hey, brother, could you do me a favor? He said, I got a big family. My dad had cancer years ago. I'd love him to hear your story. My sister had cancer about 10 years ago. She used to be a nurse, and now she's a lobbyist for patient rights. I'd love for them to meet you, and they'll love what you do. So I went, sweet. Big Mexican family, super sweet, super close, the whole deal. So I walk into the restaurant, and the dad, he's like in his 80s, pulls me over and he says, hey, my boy, this thing you're doing, Jerry told me about it, writing about what's in people's heads and what's in their hearts and what they went through. Oh my gosh, it's so important. It's so important. And I had learned that he had gone through lymphoma years before. Then the sister, Jerry's sister, his daughter, you know, in her 50s, comes over and she goes, oh my God, you know, I used to be an emergency room nurse, had stage 3 breast cancer, double mastectomy, you know, got horrified at what was happening with patients and advocacy and wellness, became a lobbyist for patient rights. And that's what I do now. It's a passion of mine. And oh my God, you know, the emotional side of it, it's just so important that people talk about it, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, wow, finally, somebody I don't need to help, right? So we have our deal, we have our lunch and everything. And at the end of the brunch, I stand up, Bobby, and I go, listen, not everybody is like you guys. They don't talk like you guys talk. And I looked at the dad and I said, imagine you being so open with your daughter. And he clasps his hands and he puts his eyes down and he goes, and he shakes his head. And I go, you just told me how important it was. And he goes, yeah, but you know, I'm old school. I don't want to burden my kids. I don't want to like make them worry about me. They might have known what I'm going through, but I'm old school. I keep it to myself. I go, but you just said how important it is. He goes, yeah, it's super important. I just never did it. And I look at the daughter and I go, well, you with your story and especially changing careers and being so passionate about it and what you just told me. She goes, no. She goes, I don't want to burden my dad. Like he's going to feel guilty. I'm going to feel guilty. Maybe he's going to lose a daughter. Maybe I'm going to remind him of what he went through, whatever he went through on the emotional side of maybe leaving his family. And now I'm going to have to leave my family we don't talk about that part of it. And I'm like, huh? And so it's just like this perfect example of no matter how close they are, no matter how close to their heart it is, people just really have a difficult time getting into the nitty gritty emotional chaos that transformations, the way it whacks you in the face with the emotional side of it. People either internalize it, they self-isolate, they push back, they don't want to burden people, they don't want to make people feel guilty. right? There's just a million reasons why we don't, but it is absolutely, Bobby, one of the most common themes that I heard when I talked to every single person was, yeah, I just don't talk about that side of it.
Wow. Do you think that is specific to cancer or is it specific to trauma?
Great question. It is a little bit related to trauma, but it's a little bit more pronounced than cancer. So I'll give you another quick story. I was working in finance and it was right around the financial collapse. And I had this very young, successful, unbelievably well-liked advisor in my office and about 100 employees or so. And he was at the end of his rope and he jumped off the building.
Okay? Oh, no.
Yeah, absolutely horrible. And I flew back from New York, got into the office. And before we could get a grief counselor in there, I walked from office to office. I mean, Bobby, by the end of the day, I was as wiped out as you could ever imagine emotionally, because every single person had a story about suicide. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but they could talk to me about it and they could tell me about it once I asked. I didn't know, right? You don't walk up to somebody, hey, guess what? I saw my dad kill himself when I was a teenager, right? You don't do that. But once we opened the door and we were able to talk about it, they were able to talk about it, right? Still emotionally, you know, difficult. I think with cancer though, Bobby, there's one extra kind of facet to it. And that's that there's a little more voodoo behind it. It's a little less predictive, right? Who doesn't know the 90-year-old lady that's been smoking and drinking her whole life that never got cancer? And yet the 32-year-old triathlete that is a vegan and has never done anything unhealthy in their life, all of a sudden gets pancreatic cancer and dies. Like, it doesn't make any sense, right?
Right.
And what happens to one person with the same treatment and the same whatever might have a totally different outcome than the next person. So I think that if you hear the word cancer or encounter cancer, it's got this next level of, oh, shoot, this could be it. Even if it's just a fear of cancer and tumors are benign, it still is like, oh my gosh, this could be the end of the line.
Right.
And so I think it really does have that extra thing. And so I think it does create a little more, like I said, isolation, a little more like darker hallways to navigate, you know?
Yeah. Because there's that aspect of there's so much fear, right? You can do everything right. You can get the wrong result. Yeah, there's a mysterious quality to it that makes us afraid.
An ominous and mysterious quality, right? Yeah. And what happens when we encounter things that are unknown, especially if they're potentially ominous, is we tend to retreat. We don't tend to attack them, right? We tend to run and hide. That's just a primal thing that we do. And so I think that it's very easy to understand. And also, how many times have you as a listener, have you, Bobby, as a friend, when somebody's told you something about cancer? Oh my God, I had a rough day today at work. Somebody told me their little kid had cancer. I didn't know what to say. I was just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And then I walked away going, I don't want to say the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Right? We just retreat.
Yeah.
Right? That was a very common theme amongst people that were going through cancer or loved ones or survivors was they lost friends. They disappeared. People disappeared because they didn't know how to talk about it. They didn't know what to say.
Didn't know what to say.
You know? And I understand that.
Yeah.
What do you say? Right? But hearing from a wide range of people who had a wide range of traumas and a vastly diverse set of emotions and strengths and weaknesses and all different tools that they brought or didn't bring to their emotional well-being, learning about what they went through and how they did or didn't deal with things really was unbelievably insightful.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've had a couple of people on the show, both of them are breast cancer survivors, and they mentioned that as well, you know, in terms of like their friends, some of their friends really stepped up and they said, Hey, here's what I'm doing to help. And others, you get uncomfortable, you know, and people don't necessarily, they don't want to make it worse. Mm-hmm. You know, but not being there probably makes it worse.
Yes. Well, look, I don't know what you need, right? If you need to be left alone or if you need to be pushed into a room and tied to a chair and being forced to talk to me, I don't know which one you need.
Right? That's right.
But you also might not know which one you need, but it's a lot easier to stay in a safe zone. A protective zone, a self-protective zone, and not explore the answer to that question, right? Mm-hmm. my personal belief is that humans, we're all looking for two things. We're looking for connection, right? Mm-hmm. And we're looking for emotional fulfillment. Now, sometimes it's negative emotions. People want to be fulfilled with negative emotions, right? But yep. We're looking for connection and we're looking for emotional fulfillment. And why I firmly believe that is I think if you're fortunate enough to, at the end of your life, be able to contemplate things, in other words, you weren't taken quickly or whatever, you didn't have your mind about you. But if you're fortunate enough to do that, I mean, really the people I've talked to only boils down to two thoughts. One, the joy of the connections and the emotional depth that they had with people, and the regrets about the connections they didn't make or the emotional depth they didn't go to with people. There wasn't much else that people dealt with. It was the joy of the connections and the emotional depth, or the regret over not having those. And so I believe that's what we all want. And so I just wanted to go about this project to say, how can we equip people to better help get them there?
Yeah. So is that what you're hoping people will, I guess, see in the stories in the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So not just like, it's not prescriptive. It doesn't say, hey, Bobby, do this or don't do mm-hmm. this with these set of circumstances. It's not like that. But each story, again, is unbelievably evocative. And I'll give you an example. Okay. So there's a guy, Dominic, and he has since passed away. But when I first talked to him, he became a good friend. When I first talked to him, he told me this crazy story of how when he was 19, passed out on the basketball court, he woke up in the hospital being told, get your things in order, you're going to die.
At 19.
At 19. Like, there's nothing we can do about it. You got blood cancer that we can't treat. You know, we'll try, but just, you're going to die. In fact, he even asked his dad if it was okay if he died, right? Because it was just like, I'm going to try to live, but dad, is it okay if I die? Because I just can't handle this, right? Then he survives. Of course, he survives. Then he goes through this horrible set of circumstances. He finds drugs. He gets addicted to Oxycontin. He starts a crime wave to fulfill his habit. He just, he didn't care about life, right? He's supposed to be dead. So about in his early 30s, the cancer recurs. Same oncologist says to him, Dominic, you defied all the odds last time, but I'm telling you this time, it's not going to happen. You're going to die, and get your things in order, and it's just going to happen. Now, we'll try to do a bone marrow transplant. We'll do whatever we can do. But he goes, you literally have no chance to live. And he lives. Okay.
Yeah.
So now 10 years later, he's in his early 40s and I'm talking to him. And we're talking about all the bad things that had happened to him, both self-inflicted and otherwise. We talked about his lack of motivation to talk to his kids in an honest way because of his embarrassment, because of all the regrets. We talked about the fact that he didn't journal. He didn't take pictures. He didn't do all the things that a normal person would want to do to give back to their kids and to their family. And, you know, even the negative things that he could bring to them, you know, his lessons learned or whatever. And he said to me, he said, because David, you don't understand, man, I've been afraid to die my whole life. I've been afraid to die my whole life. That's why I just been frozen into being a nobody. And I said, Dominic, we figured this out together. Dominic, you know, you've been afraid to live, right? You've been afraid to mm-hmm. live because everybody's told you you're going to die. And you even asked your dad if it was okay if you died. I said, you've been afraid to live. So he started living. He started going on vacations. He started journaling. He sat down with each one of his kids to tell him what was going on in his life, all the bad things that had happened in his life. He mended relationships. He had a positive outlook. He had all this great stuff happen to him. And he eventually got mesothelioma and died shortly after. Oh. That was bad. He said, I don't know if I got it in prison or in the hospital. I got it somewhere. But my point is that here's this guy that I was drawn to as a person and as a friend. And how just completely moving it was to understand that the thing that limited him from forming deep relationships was the fact that he was always afraid he was going to die or that he should have died. That teaches me a little bit about how to interact with somebody that I think I should be closer to, or I think is being held back emotionally to form deeper connections that might allow me to talk to them in a different way and maybe help them or I don't know, if I can't help them, at least interact with them in a way that maybe gives me a little more insight into what possibly could be going through their minds.
Yeah. But that's it's a big difference. Are you afraid of dying or are you afraid of living?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
mm-hmm.
it's sad what he said, you know, that's why I've always been a nobody or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sad.
It is. You know, it's like from that movie that Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
Morgan Freeman says, get busy living or get busy dying. And, you know, when you're told, you know, that it's in your head that you've been getting busy dying your whole life, you're not going to live. Mm-mm. But once you start realizing you could live. And so what I took from that is that sometimes what somebody might be going through, the distance that I might feel from them, the Heisman arm out, stay away from me, don't get close to me, might not be anything other than their fear of forming a meaningful relationship because they're afraid it's going to be snatched from them as soon as they do. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of stuff there, but it, you know what, there's just so much to learn from each one of these stories, you know?
Yeah. It sounds like it. What I was saying, and it was funny because I was thinking about the Shawshank Redemption thing too. It's one of my favorite movies. When you were talking there, David, something that went through my head is, I wonder if, you know, it's also like with the relationship you were talking about, a fear of loss versus fear of gain, mm-hmm. you know, because we're motivated by different things as well, you know? So even if it's not dying and living, it could be loss or gain, you know? And I know that, I mean, this is obviously very mission driven by you. Mm-hmm. Why this project? I know you've talked about your sister a couple times, but do you want to fill us in there?
Yeah. So, I mean, it started out as my sister's name was June, right? And I used to do a For June in June event every year, like some kind of ridiculous endurance event. Like I run like 85 miles in the Mexican desert or, you know, some stupid thing like that. And because I wanted to keep her memory alive and pay a little bit of extra attention to her, to the thought of her, and raise a little money for the cancer center that took care of her. And I just felt compelled because her and I were able to have a lot of talks near the end of her life. She was going to leave young kids and a husband behind, a lot of friends, a great lifestyle. But we were able to talk about a lot of those things. And then I was just completely moved and shocked by how few people had that experience. Right now, I'm not saying nobody did. A lot of people do. And some of the stories that I bring to you in the book explore that. Man, we've talked everything through, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked everything through, but that's kind of the exception. And so I just said, you know, as a homage to June, as a way to try to help others be better equipped to start these conversations, I got to do something meaningful. I like writing. I like stories. And all the books that I've written or I am writing are story driven. And I thought, you know, I don't want to tell one story really well because I don't know that everybody can identify that with that. But I want to tell a bunch of stories as accurately and as detailed as I can that will hopefully evoke a lot of emotion and interest by the reader so that they can be moved into action when, you know, the situation hits.
Yeah. I love that. And now with the book, I know you're donating, is it 100% of the proceeds?
Yeah. Yep. So I have a publisher. Publisher is very supportive. Books are sold through traditional ways like Amazon and Barnes and Noble or wherever. And then they receive the proceeds. They cut me a check. 100% of that check goes to be divided up between the charities. Most of them are cancer focused charities, some mentoring organization or something like that, but they're all nonprofits that were chosen by the book participants. Some books are sold other ways. You know, they're sold directly on my website or whatever. I give 100% of the proceeds there to these different organizations. So, you know, I think it's important as organizations like, Moffitt Cancer Center in Florida, Perlmutter Cancer Institute in New York, mm-hmm. you know, that's attached to NYU, American mm-hmm. Cancer Society, Children's Hospital, LA, just each one of the participants had an organization that they had an affinity towards. And I said, look, I mean, the smaller goal is to raise some money, but there's not tons of money in books, right? The bigger goal is to help people. And mm-hmm. so that was the idea. You know, my wife and I said, well, you know, we could, give a bunch of money to charity, or we can put a bunch of money into a project and give that money if there's any proceeds to charity, but really have a better purpose and kind of a dual purpose to it. So that was the reason for the book.
Yeah. Love that. And mm-hmm. now something I'm dying to ask you about, because you mentioned earlier all the endurance athlete, you know, the endurance athletes, right? Yeah. The Ironmans. And how many Ironman triathlons have you done at this point?
So I was a 38 or 9-year-old overweight smoker, on the couch, miserable life, stressed out in every facet you could ever imagine. Plus, I had 4-year-old twins that needed protecting from a bad relationship that I was in, as well as I needed protection from that. Yeah. Got us all out of that situation. And the three of us parked ourselves in a new environment. And I looked in the mirror and I said, stop it. Stop it. Just figure out what you want to do and just go do it. Like, stop being a loser, right? Stop. Just, I mean, you know, like I was trying, but you know, like take control of your life, like be who you want to be. And that's when I started running. And then I did some triathlons. I've done now 17 or 18 Ironmans. I've done multiple 50-mile runs, 100-mile runs. I did 4 back-to-back marathons one time running from Santa Barbara to Manhattan Beach, California. Done 100, 300-mile bike rides, 100-mile runs. And like I said, this almost 5,000-mile bike ride too.
Yeah. So why endurance? I mean, because you know, there's a lot of, you could have said, hey, I don't want to be a smoker. I don't want to be overweight. I'm going to the gym.
Yep.
Why the endurance athlete route?
Well, a couple of things. One is I love to dig myself a hole and figure out how to get out of it. So I've been doing that my whole life. And I figured instead of doing it on negative things, I might as well do it on a positive thing.
Yeah.
So when I would say to somebody, hey, I'm going to do an Ironman, and they go, but you're a fat smoker. How are you going to do an Ironman? I'd be like, oh, I'll watch this. I'll show you. Right. But no, really, the main part is I discovered that it is ridiculously therapeutic mentally, psychologically, emotionally. There really is. And this probably not something that a lot of people can identify with, but I bet you and your husband can, doing, you know, cross country skiing and doing some long bike rides. There's something just therapeutic about being able to shut your brain off and focus on nothing for a very long period of time. And we don't often ever do that. Mm-mm. You know, we take a break, I'm going to see a movie, take a break, I'm going to go bowling, take a break, I'm going to read a book. That's not contemplating meditative, regenerative stuff for your brain and for your heart. You know, running, although it might be difficult and it sounds kind of stupid to say running 10 hours is contemplative. Like I search ways to, if I got 4 hours, I would much rather go for a 4-hour bike, right? Than sit down and watch 2 back-to-back movies. Cause on the 4-hour bike ride, I'm going to be able to think about all the like stuff. I went on a bike ride yesterday, Bobby. It was only 35 miles, but it was unbelievably transformative because about 3/4 of the way through, I came to this great realization about the way I've been dealing with something that's the wrong way. And I said, oh, you got to change your mindset. Here's what you need to do. And blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, I never would have contemplated that thing if I hadn't been on my bike for a couple of hours, you know, with nothing to think about, where I could just deal with whatever was coming into my head that was bothering me.
Yeah. It's amazing when you're out like on the bike or the cross country skiing, it's just like this place of peace and white space.
Yeah.
You know what? The other thing about it too, is the, I don't know how you feel. I'm asked quite a bit, like, cause we live right outside the park. Right. So, you know, we go up to these passes and people pass us in their car, obviously. And I remember the one time I made it up to, it's called Farview Curve, and it's a ways up there. And there was someone and he had driven up there in his car. And he goes, oh my goodness. He said, I barely made it in my car. <You know? laughs> And he's like, why do you like cycling the passes? Right. And I don't do it every time I'm out, but there's something about the challenge of it. There's something about, when you get to that destination, it feels good.
Well, I totally identify with that. In my first book, I talked about the similarities between, to break it down to a simple sentence, the similarities between running a $100 million business and running 100 miles. Okay. Ooh. Now, yes, there's a ton of things that you could gain, you know, lessons from, but I think there's a lot of lessons, you know, about like, you know, when to give up, when not to give up. peaks and valleys, right? Understanding, you know, the things you got to set high enough goals. You got to have a plan. You got all of these things. They all make sense. But I tell this story one time about the very first endurance athletic event that I ever did. It was completely stupid for me to do it because I was still smoking, although I was less overweight. I started becoming athletic and I went and did in Georgia an 87 mile rollerblade race.
Oh man.
Imagine that 87 mile rollerblade race through the gentle rolling hills of Georgia. And there's nothing gentle about the rolling hills of Georgia, let me tell you. Not a rollerblade. So besides the people that were screaming at me to get out of the way, but there there was a lot to learn. And I remember specifically, as clear as I'm talking to you right now, Bobby, that I was making my way up this hill. It was about maybe like 35 miles into this 87 mile rollerblade race, right? That ended up taking me like something like 10 hours, right? And I'm making my way up this hill and I can't move. I'm done. And it's 87 miles. I'm 35 in. It's 90 degrees out. I'm sweating like you can't believe. And I'm looking down at the asphalt, turned sideways, because otherwise I'd roll back down the hill. And I'm seeing these drips come off my forehead. And it's creating a line by my skates. And I'm just like, I'm done. And then it hit me. Holy cow. You know what? If I figure out a way to go one step past that line, I'm going to discover something new about myself because I've never been there before. I've never pushed myself this far. So, okay, I'm going to make one step. And I go, oh, shoot, the next step you make, you're going to find something else new about yourself and something new and something new. And I think that's kind of like you going up and doing those passes is once you, now I know there's another peak that's always higher further out, but you make it up this peak and you go, oh my God, that's something I've never done. I've pushed myself to a level that I've never done, and I've discovered something about myself. I think there's something really empowering about that.
Yeah. And I'm not an endurance athlete, right? I mean, I'm not doing those things, but in biking or even in skiing, it's amazing how many times, like for me, I have a ceiling for myself. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, like for the longest time, especially up here, you know, because we live in the Rockies, to average 15 miles an hour on my bike was like, oh man, I'll never do that. You know, I'll never do that. For the first time, because I changed the way I was training, for the first time, I think it was 3 weeks ago, I hit 15 miles an hour and I was so excited for the whole ride. I was like, yes.
Right.
Every time out since then, I've been better than that. Today it was 16.25.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, so every time like we encounter that ceiling and we we go through it. It's like, oh, the world just changed a little bit.
It did. And you can then apply that to anything, right?
Everything.
Yeah. You can apply it to anything. That's what I love about endurance athletics is for me, it's filtered down to many areas of my life. And it also gives you credibility when you're talking to friends, a loved one, your kids, employees, your boss, whomever. It gives you some credibility when you say something like, you need to set your goals a little bit higher. You know, I've said to my kids how many times, yeah, it's supposed to be hard. You know, don't tell me it's hard. It's supposed to be. You're trying to do something that's supposed to be hard. So if you accept the fact that it's supposed to be hard, it's kind of like I woke up one day and said, I want to run 50 miles and I hadn't done any training. Okay. Now, if I'm going to complain about being hard, why am I doing it? It's supposed to be hard. I'm going to focus on how to get it done. So when you're working on your dissertation, when you're working on a final, when you're having to deal with teachers that aren't being fair, it's supposed to be hard. Right?
Yeah.
So let that go. Right. And that gives you some credibility and maybe, you know, I'm not saying authority as much as it just, you can speak from the heart. Right. And not just pull words. Right.
Yeah.
You speak from the heart.
Well, and it's very authentic too.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing too, that I've noticed too, is so many times when something is hard, we spend so much time complaining about it being hard. It's like, we're wasting all of our energy. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. Like this was back in 2003, I got sick, nearly died. And I remember one of the first doctors, actually it was like the third or fourth doctor, but we went to him and he told me, he's like, you know, you have like a 3% chance of recovering. And when we went home that day, my now husband, then boyfriend, he said, wow, you know, I'm so sorry. This isn't fair. I'm like, at this point, it doesn't matter if it's fair. It doesn't matter. It is.
It just is.
It just is. So now what? You know, and sometimes, you know, it's the same thing in a number of different areas in life. Yeah, I can totally see what you're saying. It gives you that kind of, it gives you the platform to speak on that to your kids.
Yeah. And there's a really amazing cyclist. He's now retired, but he had this wonderful thing. I learned a lesson early on in life, and I didn't apply it really to too many things athletic. But then once I started doing, you know, being an endurance athlete, I applied it. But in life, I applied it, and that was enjoy the pain, right? Because one day it's going to be gone, so you might as well enjoy it. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting thing. So the cyclist, he would have painted on his bike, shut up legs.
I love that.
And his all of his fans would be holding up signs, you know, as he's trying to, you know, do a breakaway in the Tour de France up a hill because he's not a climber. And they would hold up signs to say, shut up legs. And it's like, he knew his legs were going to hurt, right?
They're going to hurt.
He's just saying, shut up legs, because he's got bigger things to do. So he's not going like, he's just like, I got it. I'm going to do it. Just shut up. Let me do my business. I love that. You know, enjoy the pain. I love that.
I love the shut up legs. When I used to, I've done Vail Pass a few times, and there's a part, and it's probably been painted over by now, but for a while, there's this huge section of it, and it was one of the hardest sections of it. And it just said, shut up legs.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, because you know what? When you're climbing, your legs are going to hurt.
Yeah.
You're going to feel it, you know? And it's like, but it's true. Just, I have one job to do, and that's make the pedals move.
Right.
That's it. That's all I've got. It's amazing. Focus comes down to one thing, make the pedals move.
Yeah. And I tell myself that when I'm doing Ironmans that are hilly, or if I'm on some crazy bike ride, I'll just be like channeling my inner Jens and say, shut up legs.
Yeah, that's it. So real quickly, if someone's listening and they're like, maybe, you know, close to where you were before, you know, spending more time on the couch, but they want to make a big shift, maybe not to be an endurance athlete, but to be healthier. What would you say to them?
Look, we can come up with a million excuses. I don't care. Whatever you say, there's somebody that has it tougher. There's somebody that's busier. There's somebody that has more things to overcome. Every excuse is stupid. Let me tell you super quick about Patricia. Okay.
Yeah.
So Patricia had 5 different cancers.
Oh.
And I don't mean like a little tumor removed, which is still unbelievably dramatic, right? I'm not downgrading that at all, but I'm saying she had some serious cancers, thyroid cancer, breast cancer. You name it, on and on and on. But her story, Bobby, was really about how she endured a unbelievably difficult, abusive, physically abusive, emotionally abusive relationship for 4 years, where she was literally beaten on a regular basis, sent to the hospital, couldn't have friends, couldn't have a phone, couldn't talk to anybody, couldn't look at anybody. It was horrible. Like, just horrible. She got out, created a new identity, and found love. Like, how do you find love after being abused for 4 years at the most extreme levels? And then as soon as she met the love of her life, she encounters the first of 5 cancers. Okay.
It's cruel. It's
cruel. Now, if I were to tell you in answer to your question, well, just get up out of bed and start walking and walk to go get your tennis shoes on and go for a walk. At least that's a start. If I were to tell you that, you'd be like, ah, shut up. You're like, what do you know? But when I hear Patricia's story and I asked her, I said to her, I said, Patricia, what is it that kept you going? What is it that motivated you after all of the turmoil that you went through, and especially then encountering your first cancer? Like, what was it? And she goes, David, she goes, I might not have gotten very far, but every single day I attempted to get up out of the bed. Sometimes all I could do is put my feet on the ground. Sometimes I could get up out of bed. And if I did get up out of bed, I made my bed. And maybe sometimes I had to go back and lay back into it. But then maybe other days I got out of bed, I made my bed, and I walked to go put on shoes. And then sometimes I made it to go for a walk. Sometimes I made it to go through my whole day. So my point is that if I would have heard that when I was younger, I would have been a lot less excuse driven in my life about the things that I know I want to do. I want to be healthy. I want to live longer. I want to be a good example for my kids. I want to accomplish things I never thought I could accomplish. I want to not waste another day or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. All of these things that we all could perhaps want to do. If I would have heard her story and realized, man, for her, just putting her feet on the ground was like step one. And then she'd go do everything. When you say, hey, just take your first step, now it means something to me. So that's what I would say to them is you don't get that day back, right? You might not be in a position to be able to make that choice at some point. I mean, just enough with the excuses and just do it. Like, just do it.
Yeah. If all you can do is take one step, that's all right.
Fine.
Take two tomorrow.
How about instead of eating the whole pack of Chips Ahoy cookies, eat half the pack and throw the rest away.
Yeah. That's a start. Right? That's a victory.
I stop making excuses. Just do it. And nobody's perfect. I'm certainly not perfect. I make a lot of mistakes. I sometimes cut myself enough slack where I go, man, you've been really like off the wagon, but that's okay. Cause I'll get back on it tomorrow. Like whatever, like nobody's perfect, but I'm just saying, no more excuses. Just figure out, we all have time for what's important. And if you don't have your health, if you don't have your mental fitness, if you don't have strong emotional connections to the people in your life, right, then just start doing it. Start doing it. Just stop being who you are if you don't like it, and just turn the page. Go. Get your feet on the ground. Go.
Because that's a great thing about life. We get to turn the page. We get to start writing again.
Yeah.
You know, the worst thing we can do is not like where we are and not change anything. Because if we don't change anything, we're going to be in that same spot again tomorrow and the next year and whatever. I heard someone say this years ago, you're going to be 10 years older either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You might as well at least try to do something different. So I love that. Where can people learn more about you, your speaking, the books, how they can reach out, all that kind of good stuff?
Oh, thanks. So the books sold wherever books are sold. You know, Amazon's where most books are sold, but Amazon, Barnes and Noble, anywhere online. You can buy signed copies on my website, cycleoflives.org. So cycleoflives.org. I list the charities we give all the money to, and there's links to some good articles and, you know, some information about me and the books. And I do some public speaking, probably do a lot more if we ever get back to in-person public speaking. There's where they can find out more. And I would just say that the one thing I am 100% positive, if everybody does read the book, it's way more inspirational and uplifting than you think it is. But the one thing for sure is every single person has told me that's read it, that's given me some feedback, has said it's given them some fuel. It's giving them some arrows that they can put in their quiver, some fuel they can put in their tank, that when they hit a situation, they are going to be more powered to be able to go through and deal with it the way they need to deal with it. You know?
Yeah.
They're like, oh my gosh, I maybe am going to handle it a different when my friend says something, you know, and I need to be there for them. Or if they give me the strong arm and keep me away, I maybe know how to ask if that's really what they want or something else or whatever. Maybe I might have a better idea of what they might be going through, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think, for sure, if anybody does take the time to look it up, if there's nothing you do other than grab the book for how to, it will help you deal with those emotional issues with others, for sure.
Wow. I mean, and really what could be better than that?
I think nothing. I mean, honestly, I think nothing.
Yeah. That's got to be really validating for you.
It is. And I don't want to say it from a point of ego. I want to say it from the point of, I feel like I'm very fortunate to have brought these stories to. I'll tell you this super quick, Bobby. I get a call from an email from a doctor who read my book. He had been a gastroenterology oncologist and then left to go do other things. And he sent me a note and he said, hey, can we talk? And we talked and he goes, I just want to let you know, the first time I read your book, I was absolutely horrified because I thought to myself, what a crappy doctor I must have been because I didn't understand what people were going through. On the emotional side, I didn't bond enough with them. He said, and we talked through that. And I said, well, just the fact that you're asking yourself that question means you probably weren't.
Yeah.
But he said, then I read it the second time and I tried to apply it to what I might be able to do differently in the future. And I thought, man, that is awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody who had been dealing with this at a level I could never understand his whole life was moved by these stories and moved to action by these stories, that I just feel like I'm super fortunate about that, you know?
Yeah, that's powerful. And
yeah, right?
It speaks to it a lot too, that he went back and read it a second time.
I know.
I mean, how many times do you do that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's an easy read in that each story is self-contained.
Oh, I love
that.
So
you don't have to sit down and read from start to finish. I mean, yeah, it's good if you start to finish because the narrative in between the stories, but you could read one story, which is 17 pages, and be done with it for however long, pick it up, and it's a new story. It reads quick, you know?
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you so much for being here, for sharing that, for doing the work that you're doing. I also, you know, thanks for talking about the endurance athlete, you know, and because I love that. I'm always interested. I've had a few other people on who have done the 50 mile ultra marathons.
Yep.
And it's always, I don't know, it's just always fascinating to hear more. So I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's shocking what you can do if you set a high enough goal, or a crazy enough goal, or a stupid enough goal, whatever you want to call it.
Sometimes the best goals are kind of pushing the...
Yeah, totally. But thank you. No, you're very welcome. And thank you for having me on, Bobby. It's really been a real joy talking with you.
Awesome. I hope that you found both inspiration and a ton of insight in that interview. Here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, we tend to retreat when we encounter something that we fear. Ironically, when we retreat, we miss the opportunity to break through it and potentially either connect with others or connect more deeply with ourselves. Number two, I thought that Dominic's story was very compelling and how he told David that his whole life he'd been afraid of dying, and that was what led him to playing small. I thought it was a really powerful reframing when he and David arrived at the realization that maybe he wasn't afraid of dying. Maybe he was afraid of living. Once he made that shift, things opened up for him. But as I was listening to David recount that story, it made me think about how many people are truly afraid of living, of putting themselves out there, of going for what they want, of being true to themselves. We only get one shot at this. Let's make it count. And number three, quoting David, excuses are stupid. We will never get a day back that we surrender to an excuse. If you found this episode helpful, please share it on your social media and tag me so that I can thank you for the support. It's through people like you sharing the podcast that we are growing, and your support means the world to us. I started this podcast to help people truly become the author of their own lives, regardless of what obstacles might pop up. I believe that that is how we unlock our true destiny, our true story. So today, I will leave you with this challenge. This week, be intentional about being true to and unlocking your authentic destiny, and don't settle for less.